At best, you get compromise. At worst, you get adversarialism and fighting and negative forms of synergy where 1 + 1 equals less than 1. Because so much of the energy of both parties is spent on fighting each other rather than dealing directly with the issues. You see, we always see the world not as it is, but as we are. So we must constantly seek to understand, and most of us tend to think we see the world as it is, that we're objective, and that we're looking through our lens of wisdom and experience, but in fact we're looking through our lens of conditioning, of prior scripting. We referred to that as a paradigm before, a pair of glasses, a frame of reference out of which we operate, the implicit assumptions that we operate on, or the map.
Habit 7. Sharpen the saw.
The final habit, Habit 7, sharpen the saw, is the habit of renewal. What are you doing? Well, can't you see I'm sawing down this tree? Oh, I'll bet you're tired. I am. Well, how long you been doing it? Oh, I don't know, 2, 3 hours? I'll bet you're beat. Boy, I'll say, I've never been so tired. Well, why don't you sharpen the saw? I'm too busy sawing, dum-dum. Have you ever been too busy driving to take time to get gas? The opposite of sharpening the saw is to leave it dull until the blade breaks, until the mind becomes dull, the spirit insensitive, the body flabby, where everything has gone to pot, literally and figuratively. To sharpen the saw is basically to say, I'm going to keep renewing myself and keeping my entire life in balance. It's fundamentally the concept of continuous improvement, continuous learning, forever getting better. Habit 7, in a sense, is the habit that focuses on production capability. Habit 7, if done right, automatically renews and develops the other 6 habits because it takes a high level of proactivity and of responsibility and initiative to consistently sharpen the saw. But here's the problem. Habit 7 lies in quadrant 2. It's important, however, it's not urgent. That's why most people neglect it. In fact, all of the habits lie in quadrant 2. They're all terribly important, but not urgent. And habit 7, which in a sense enables all the other 6 habits to be constantly renewed, obviously is important but not urgent. It does not act upon us. We must act upon it. Otherwise, if we neglect this, our lives become disordered. We do things unsystematically. We hit and miss, and then we end up with imbalanced lives and imbalanced organizations that focus myopically only on one dimension. Basically, there are 4 dimensions in life: the body, the mind, the spirit, and our relationships, that is, the social-emotional side. Let's look at each one in turn. Under physical, we usually think about these elements of renewal: exercise, nutrition, and stress management, so that we're not crippled and paralyzed from being overstressed, overtaxed, worn out, burned out. Regarding exercise, there is more and more consciousness throughout all society about the importance of it, and the effect it has upon our body, upon our sense of well-being, our fitness. But you know, the main benefit isn't necessarily physical fitness. It's what happens to your self-esteem. It's what happens to your sense of being in control of your life. It's the spillover effect into the other dimensions, the emotional, the social, and the spiritual, that often are the primary benefits of physical exercise, even beyond physical fitness, as great as that is. Beyond feeling better, looking better, and nutrition is also becoming increasingly important, where we learn to subordinate taste to nutrition, to what is good for us, and people inwardly know so much that they do not now do. Let's look at stress for a moment. There's so much written about it, and so many programs that focus on a number of different things, such as meditation, biofeedback, exercise, and so forth, and I think these are all excellent. But I'm convinced that the greatest stress management idea I have ever learned lies in having a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, and a sense of integrity around a value system. In the language of Hans Selye, the international expert on stress, to have this kind of meaningful work creates eustress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, not distress. And eustress strengthens the immune systems, slows down the degenerative forces of the body, and strengthens our whole ability to cope with the realities of life. I also believe that the stress of a conscience that has been violated again and again transcends by far the stress of deadlines, pressing meetings, and having a dozen balls in the air at the same time. So I think we should deal with both sides of stress, the environmental and the profoundly personal, in cultivating a sense of meaning, of purpose, and of living by our conscience around principle-centered values. Now let's look at the mental dimension. To put forth a great effort to keep our minds vital, alert, and alive. To get into reading, to turn the television way down. Get back to reading. Give yourself the challenge of reading a book a month, and then perhaps a book a week, and read broadly, widely, deeply, even outside your own comfort zone, so that you're constantly expanding and deepening your horizons. And writing is one of the most powerful mental tools. To learn to write. In fact, I don't know any discipline to the mind as powerful as writing, more demanding, taking more concentration of effort. I believe that what exercise is to the body, reading is to the mind, but writing is like concentrated mental exercise because you have to gather and distill and crystallize into words for another person's mind, and it causes you to think empathically and to get very conscious about the communication processes. I commend to you also the keeping of a journal, a personal history. I commend to you writing letters again, for the art of letter writing is just about gone with the convenience of the telephone and more recently the email and the internet. But learning to express your thoughts deeply and beautifully to other people is one of the great arts in life. The spiritual dimension is a very private area. People do it in their own way, but basically it means to renew yourself in your value system, in your sense of purpose and meaning and vision, in what you deeply, deeply believe in and value, what you treasure. Work on this mission statement. Work diligently on it until it gradually crystallizes within you. When it gets settled into your core, then keep going back to it. Exploring it to see if it still is relevant to your present situation. You write it as if it will be forever, but you have to keep looking at it. You try to make it up of principles that are timeless and universal and self-explanatory. Sometimes it helps to get into nature, to get into meadows, in forests, at an ocean, or even in visual images of these things, so that you're always being grounded into the earth. There's a power that comes from this that does not come from artificial made things. Sometimes you can renew it by renewing your commitments, your vows to your loved ones, to whatever is important and sacred to you. Sometimes you can renew your spirit by studying the great literature that inspires you, from praying and pondering, from trying to get a sense of reaching to a higher level, of making a difference, of contributing, of just getting out of your own world and your own satisfactions. To be courageous in the hard moments, little by little, the conscience is made strong and viable and powerful. It gives you tremendous social courage as well. You can learn to say no to all kinds of temptations and expedient compromising paths. Your conscience becomes strong. It feeds you. It feeds your sense of identity and worth. It gives you a sense of abundance so that your sense of worth does not come from being compared. All of this is part of the spiritual sharpening of the saw. As I mentioned, all people do it differently. It is such a private and personal world. But it must not be neglected because it is part of our very natures. Now finally, let's look at the social-emotional dimension. Social means your relationships with others, and emotional refers to your relationship with yourself in relation to others as well as with yourself. One of the most powerful action steps you can take after today is to begin the process of rebuilding a broken relationship you care about enormously. Reach out to touch the one that tests you the very most. Rebuild that relationship you care so much about, but which is strained and which has been wounded. Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the United Nations of an earlier era, put it this way. It is more noble to give yourself completely to one individual than to labor diligently for the salvation of the masses. In other words, you can be very dedicated for many causes out there, worthy causes, projects, business activities, spending 10, 12, 14 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week, and yet not have a meaningful relationship with your own teenage son. And that will eat at you. It weakens your fiber and your will. It affects the totality of your life in some sense. If there's a sense of enmity within you, it will spread out and affect other things. Negative energy is like a metastasizing cancer that spreads out and affects the totality of our life. Positive energy also has the same pervasive effect on everything in our life. So if you can nurture all of the key relationships of your life, it is amazing the kind of moral and social courage it gives you in other relationships, business, community, church, or whatever. You'll also find that in your efforts to rebuild some one relationship you care about a great deal, that it creates more nobility of character within that will affect all other relationships. The key, in a sense, to the 99 is the one, because everyone is a one. The key to the many is the one. Why? Because what you have to do to develop and educate and discipline your character affects everything that you do in your life. It literally has exponential leveraging capacity in all relationships. The home is usually the perfect place for the social-emotional renewal. Spending time together at the family dinner, having special family traditions, holidays, birthdays, playing together, relaxing together, worshiping together, laughing, empathically listening to each other, honoring each other, lifting each other up when there is discouragement and despair, encouraging each other, nurturing each other's emotional bank account, affirming each other, all of this is so vital and part of this social and emotional sharpening the saw. So to be committed to Habit 7 is to continuously jumpstart your own mind and spirit and body and your relationships on a consistent basis. And that, to me, is the first early commitment to make now. Don't ever neglect sharpening the saw. Don't come up with reasons for not doing it. Pay the price, my friends. The dividends are unbelievably marvelous. Let me share with you now a few thoughts and challenges to encourage you in the process of developing these habits. One of the most important things you can do right now is to begin to share these ideas with others. When you teach once, you learn twice. You learn better. It deepens your commitment to apply. It also unfreezes the labels that people have of you because they see you growing and learning, and they give you new opportunities to change and to become better. So when you teach other people and share with your family, your work associates, and others who might have an interest, that's when the real learning begins to take place. It is in the teaching and in the sharing and in the living. Sometimes it helps to focus on a single habit. You don't try to change everything at once. However, you'll find that the habits are so interwoven that any time you begin to work on one of them in a significant, deep way, it will affect all of the rest. But start with those things that are most important for you to work on right now. And remember, don't ever give up. Be patient. A strong character is not developed overnight. Choose to live your life based upon principles. All of the 7 habits are based on universal principles which have endured through the ages. How do you know that they are universal, timeless, and self-evident? Just try arguing against any one of them and imagine a highly effective person with no sense of responsibility, Habit 1, no vision, Habit 2, no integrity, Habit 3, no mutual respect, Habit 4, no mutual understanding, Habit 5, no creative cooperation, Habit 6. No renewal, Habit 7. The power of these habits is in the doing, in the living, in the continuous day-by-day improvements. It's a constant effort. We need to make these habits and these principles a part of our very life. But it takes great patience. Consider the Chinese bamboo tree that is planted and you see nothing for 4 years except a little bulb and a little shoot coming from it. But literally you work diligently day in and day out to optimize the whole growing situation and you see nothing On the 5th year, the Chinese bamboo tree grows up to 80 feet. All of the growth goes above the ground, where before all of the growth went below the ground. To some degree, there is some relevance here. The first three habits of the private victory are, in a sense, below the ground. And above the ground represents habits 4, 5, and 6 and our relationships with other people. Another thing I'm sure you've learned about these habits is that you already know them. They already live in your own heart. In fact, I love the quote from T.S. Eliot, who identified this deep inner knowing and awareness. He said, "We must never cease from exploring, and the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we began and know the place for the first time." Again, you see, in a very real sense, you already know these habits in your heart. But the exciting thing is to embark on a lifelong adventure of learning them, of sharing them, of literally internalizing them, and living them to the point that you can experience the magnificent fruits that will come in the totality of your lives and in all of your relationships.
Hello and welcome to this special audio program of The Eighth Habit, From Effectiveness to Greatness, written and voiced by Dr. Stephen R. Covey. I'm Boyd Craig, director of Stephen R. Covey Publishing, and it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Covey in this new audio program. In The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Dr. Covey showed us how to become effective. Here in The Eighth Habit, his long-awaited audiobook, he opens up an entirely new dimension of human potential and shows us that we as individuals and organizations have within us the capacity to achieve greatness. Being effective as individuals and organizations is no longer merely an option. Survival in today's world requires it. But in order to thrive, innovate, excel, and lead in what Stephen calls the new knowledge worker age, we must build on and move beyond effectiveness. The call of this new era in human history is for greatness. It is for fulfillment, passionate execution, and significant contribution. Accessing the higher levels of human genius and motivation in today's new reality requires a sea change in thinking, a new mindset, a new skill set, a new tool set, in short, a whole new habit. Now here is Dr. Covey.
The Eighth Habit, From Effectiveness to Greatness. Why an Eighth Habit? The world has profoundly changed since The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People was published in 1989. The challenges and complexity we face in our personal lives and relationships, in our families, in our professional lives, and in our organizations are of a different order of magnitude. In fact, many mark 1989, the year we witnessed the fall of the Berlin Wall, as the beginning of the information age, the birth of a new reality, a sea change of incredible significance, truly a new era. Many have asked whether the seven habits are still relevant in today's new reality. My answer is always the same. The greater the change and the more difficult the challenges, the more relevant they become. You see, the seven habits are about becoming highly effective. They represent a complete framework of universal, timeless principles of character and human effectiveness. In short, principles never change. They are universal. They apply everywhere. They are timeless. And they are essentially self-evident, such as, you can never sustain trust without trustworthiness. That is a self-evident principle. But being effective as individuals and organizations is no longer optional in today's highly competitive world. It is simply the price of entry to the playing field. But surviving, thriving, innovating, excelling, and leading in this new reality will require us to build on and reach beyond effectiveness. The call and need of a new era is for greatness. It's for fulfillment, passionate execution, and significant contribution. These are on a different plane or dimension. They are different in kind, just as significance is different in kind, not in degree, from success. Tapping into the higher reaches of human genius and motivation, what we could call voice, requires a new mindset, a new skill set, a new tool set, a new habit. The eighth habit, then, is not about adding one more habit to the seven, one that somehow got forgotten. It's about seeing and harnessing the power of a third dimension to the seven habits that meets the central challenge of the new knowledge worker age. This eighth habit is find your voice and inspire others to find theirs. The eighth habit represents the pathway to the enormously promising side of today's reality. It stands in stark contrast to the pain and frustration of the voices I've been describing. In fact, it is a timeless reality. It is the voice of the human spirit, full of hope and intelligence, resilient by nature, boundless in its potential to serve the common good. This voice also encompasses the soul of organizations that will survive and thrive and profoundly impact the future of the world. In your mind's eye, try to envision, to imagine four overlapping circles. The nexus, or the intersection area, representing voice, one's unique personal significance. These are the four circles that overlap. Talent, what you're good at. Passion, what you love doing. Conscience, what you feel is right, what you should be doing. And need. Need is the area where there is pain, where there is hurt, where there is a place to add value in all parts of society. Talent, passion, conscience, and need. Overlapping. The intersection area is voice. One's unique personal significance. Voice is exactly that. Unique personal significance. Significance that is revealed as we face our greatest challenges and which makes us equal to them. As I've mentioned, voice lies at the nexus of talent, your natural gifts and strengths, passion, those things that naturally energize, excite, motivate, and inspire you. Need, including what the world needs enough to pay you for, that can drive your economic engine. And conscience, that still, small voice within, that assures you of what is right and what prompts you to actually do it. When you engage in work that taps your talents and fuels your passion, that rises out of a great need in the world that you feel drawn by conscience to meet, therein lies your voice, your calling, your soul's code. There is a deep, innate, almost inexpressible yearning within each one of us to find our own voice in life. The exponential revolutionary explosion of the Internet is one of the most powerful modern manifestations of this truth. The Internet is perhaps the perfect symbol of the new world, of the information knowledge worker economy, and of the dramatic changes that have occurred. In their 1999 book, Clue Train Manifesto, authors Locke, Levine, Searles, and Weinberger put it this way. Quote, "All of us are finding our voices again, learning how to talk to one another. Inside, outside, there's a conversation going on today that hasn't happened at all 5 years ago and hasn't been very much in evidence since the Industrial Revolution began. Now, spanning the planet via the Internet and World Wide Web, this conversation is so vast, so multifaceted, that trying to figure out what it's about is futile. It's about a billion years of pent-up hopes and fears and dreams, coated in serpentine double helixes, the collective flashback déjà vu of our strange, perplexing species. Something ancient, elemental, sacred, something very, very funny that's broken loose in the pipes and wires of the 21st century. There are millions and millions of threads in this conversation, but at the beginning and end of each one is a human being. This fervid desire for the web bespeaks a longing so intense that it can only be understood as spiritual. A longing indicates something is missing in our lives. What is missing is the sound of the human voice. The spiritual lure of the web is the promise of the return of voice." Close quote. Rather than further describe voice, let me illustrate it through the true story of one man. When I met Muhammad Yunus, founder of the Grameen Bank, a unique organization established for the sole purpose of extending microcredit to the poorest of the poor, I asked him when and how he had gained his vision. He said he didn't have any vision to begin with at all. He simply saw someone in need and tried to fill it, and the vision evolved. Muhammad Yunus's vision of a poverty-free world was set in motion with a little simple event on the streets of Bangladesh. While interviewing him for my syndicated column on leadership, he shared his story with me. Listen to his words. "It all started 25 years ago. I was teaching economics at a university in Bangladesh. The country was in the middle of a famine. I felt terrible. Here I was, teaching the elegant theories of economics in the classroom with all the enthusiasm of a brand new PhD from the United States. But I would walk out of the classroom and see skeletons all around me, people waiting to die. I felt that whatever I had learned, whatever I was teaching, was all make-believe stories with no meaning for people's lives. So I started trying to find out how people lived in the village next door to the university campus. I wanted to find out whether there was anything I could do as a human being to delay or to stop the death, even for one single person. I abandoned the bird's eye view that lets you see everything from above, from the sky. I assumed a worm's eye view, trying to find whatever comes right in front of you. Smell it. Touch it. See if you can do something about it. One particular incident took me in a new direction. I met a woman who was making bamboo stools. After a long discussion, I found out that she made only 2 US pennies each day. I couldn't believe anybody could work so hard and make such beautiful bamboo stools, yet make such a tiny amount of profit. She explained to me that because she didn't have the money to buy the bamboo to make the stools, she had to borrow from the trader. And the trader imposed the condition that she had to sell the product to him alone, at a price that he decided. and that explains the 2 pennies. She was virtually in bonded labor to this person. And how much did the bamboo cost? She said, oh, about 20 cents. For a very good one, 25 cents. I thought, people suffer for 20 cents, and there is nothing anyone can do about it? I debated whether I should give her 20 cents. But then I came up with another idea. Let me make a list of people who needed that kind of money. I took a student of mine, and we went around the village for several days, and came up with a list of 42 such people. When I added up the total amount they needed, I got the biggest shock of my life. It added up to $27. I felt ashamed of myself for being part of a society which could not provide even $27 to 42 hard-working, skilled human beings. To escape that shame, I took the money out of my pocket and gave it to my student and said, "You take this money and give it to those 42 people that we met and tell them this is a loan, but they can pay me back whenever they are able to. In the meantime, they can sell their products wherever they can get a good price." After receiving the money, they were very excited. And seeing that excitement made me think, what do I do now? I thought of the branch bank, which was located on the campus of the university, and I went to the manager and suggested that he lend money to the poor people that I had met in the village. He fell from the sky. He said, "You are crazy. It's impossible. How could we lend money to poor people? They are not creditworthy." I pleaded with him and said, "At least give it a try. Find out. It's only a small amount of money." He said, "No, our rules don't permit it. They cannot offer collateral, and such a tiny amount is not worth lending." He suggested that I see the high officials in the banking hierarchy in Bangladesh. I took his advice, and I went to the people who matter in the banking section. Everyone told me the same thing. Finally, after several days of running around, I offered myself as a guarantor. I'll guarantee the loan. I'll sign whatever they want me to sign, and they can give me the money, and I'll give it to the people that I want to. So that was the beginning. They warned me repeatedly that the poor people who receive the money will never pay it back. I said, "I'll take a chance." And the surprising thing was, they repaid me every penny. I got very excited and came to the manager and said, "Look, they pay back. There's no problem." But he said, "Oh no, they're just fooling you. Soon they will take more money and never pay you back." So I gave them more money, and they paid me back. I told this to the manager again, but he said, "Well, maybe you can do it in one village, but if you do it in 2 villages, it won't work." And I hurriedly did it in 2 villages, and it worked. So it became a kind of struggle between me and the bank manager and his colleagues in the highest positions. They kept saying that a larger number, 5 villages probably, will show it. So I did it in 5 villages, and it only showed that everybody paid back. Still, they didn't give up. They said 10 villages, 50 villages, 100 villages. And so it became a kind of contest between them and me. I came up with results that they could not deny because it was their money that I was giving. But they would not accept it because they are trained to believe that poor people are not reliable. Luckily, I was not trained that way, so I could believe whatever I was seeing as it revealed itself. But the bankers' minds, their eyes were blinded by the knowledge they had. Finally, I had the thought, why am I trying to convince them? I am totally convinced that poor people can take money and pay it back. Why don't we set up a separate bank? That excited me, and I wrote down the proposal and went to the government to get the permission to set up a bank. It took me 2 years to convince the government. On October 2nd, 1983, we became a bank, a formal, independent bank. And what excitement for all of us, now that we had our own bank and we could expand as we wished, and expand we did. Each year, they lend about $500 million. They lend even to beggars to help them come out of begging and start selling. Grameen Bank now works in more than 46,000 villages in Bangladesh through 1,267 branches with over 12,000 staff members. They have lent more than $4.5 billion in loans of $12 to $15, averaging under $200. A housing loan is $300. These are small numbers to those of us in business, but think in terms of the individual impact. To lend $500 million annually required 3.7 million people, 96% of whom are women, to make a decision that they could and would take steps to change their lives and the lives of their families. 3.7 million people had to decide that they were capable of creating change. 3.7 million people survived the sleepless night to show up trembling but committed at the Grameen office the next morning. At the heart of this empowerment lies individual women who chose individually and in synergistic, norm-producing groups to become self-reliant, independent entrepreneurs producing goods out of their own homes or neighborhoods or backyards to become economically viable and successful. They found their voice. The overlapping of passion, talent, to meet need as driven by conscience. As I have studied and interviewed some of the world's great leaders, I notice that their sense of vision and voice has usually evolved slowly. I am sure there are exceptions. Some may have a vision of what is possible suddenly burst upon their consciousness. But generally speaking, I find that vision comes as people sense human need and respond to their conscience in trying to meet that need. And when they meet that need, they see another and meet that, and on. Little by little, they begin to generalize a sense of need and start thinking of ways to institutionalize their efforts so that they can be sustained. This taps deeply into their talents and into their passion. Muhammad Yunus is an example of a man who did exactly that, sensed human need and responded to conscience by applying his talent and passion to meet that need, first personally, then in building trust and searching for creative solutions to problems, and finally by institutionalizing the capacity to fill the needs of society through an organization. He found his voice in inspiring others to find theirs. Again, he found his voice in inspiring others to find theirs. The microcredit, sometimes called microfinancing movement, is now spreading across the entire world. Mother Teresa once said, "Few of us can do great things, but all of us can do small things with great love." We are witnesses to one of the most significant shifts in human history. Peter Drucker, one of the greatest management thinkers of our time, puts it this way. In a few hundred years, when the history of our time is written from a long-term perspective, it is likely that the most important event those historians will see is not technology, not the internet, not e-commerce. It is an unprecedented change in the human condition. For the first time, literally, substantial and rapidly growing numbers of people have choices. For the first time, they will have to manage themselves. And society is totally unprepared for it. Close quote. To understand the core problem and the profound implications of Drucker's prophetic statement, we must look first at the context of history. namely, the five ages of civilization's voice. First, the hunter and gatherer age. Second, the agricultural age. Third, the industrial age. Fourth, the information, knowledge worker age. And finally, an emerging age of wisdom. Imagine for a moment that you take a step back in time and are a hunter and a gatherer of food. Each day you go out with a bow and arrow or stones and sticks to gather food for your family. That's all you've ever known, seen, and done to survive. Now imagine someone comes up to you and tries to persuade you to become what he calls a farmer. What do you think your response would be? You see him go out and scratch the earth and throw little seeds into the ground, and you see nothing. You see him watering the soil and removing weeds, and you still see nothing. But eventually, you see a great harvest. You notice his yield as a farmer is 50 times greater than yours as a hunter and gatherer. And you are considered one of the best. What would you do? You would likely say to yourself, even if I wanted to, I couldn't do that. I don't have the skills. I don't have the tools. You just wouldn't know how to work that way. But the farmer is so productive that you see him making enough money to send his kids to school and give them great opportunities. And you are barely surviving. Little by little, you're drawn to go through the intense learning process of becoming a farmer. You raise your children and grandchildren as farmers. That's exactly what happened in our early history. There was a downsizing of hunters and gatherers of over 90%. They lost their jobs. By choice. Several generations pass, and along comes the industrial age. People build factories and learn specialization, delegation, and scalability, and replicability. They learn how to take raw materials through an assembly line with very high levels of efficiency. The productivity of the industrial age goes up 50 times over the family farm. Now, if you were a farmer producing 50 times more than hunters and gatherers, and all of a sudden you see an industrial factory rise up and start outproducing the family farm by 50 times, what would you say? You might be jealous, even threatened. But what would you need to be a player in the industrial age? You would need a completely new skill set and tool set. More importantly, you'd need a new mindset, a new way of thinking. The fact is that the factory of the industrial age produced 50 times more than the family farm, and over time, 90% of the farmers were downsized. Those who survived in farming took the industrial age concept and created the industrialized farm. So today, only 3% of the people in the United States are farmers, who produce most of the food for the entire country and much of the world. Do you believe that the information knowledge worker age we're moving into will outproduce the industrial age 50 times? Think about it. I believe it will. We're just barely beginning to see it. It will outproduce it 50 times, not twice, not 3 or 10 times, but 50 or more. Nathan Myhrvold, former chief technology officer at Microsoft, put it this way. The top software developers are more productive than average software developers, not by a factor of 10 times, or 100 times, or even 1,000 times, but by 10,000 times. Close quote. Quality knowledge work is so valuable that unleashing its potential offers organizations an extraordinary opportunity for value creation. If that is true, just think of the value of unleashing the potential of your children. Knowledge work leverages all of the other investments that an organization or a family has already made. In fact, knowledge workers are the link to all of the organization's other investments. They provide focus, creativity, and leverage in utilizing those investments to better achieve the organization's objectives. The same exact thinking would apply to a family. or for a not-for-profit organization, or to a school, or a hospital, or whatever. Do you believe the knowledge worker age will eventually bring about a downsizing of up to 90% of the industrial age workforce? I believe it. Current outsourcing and unemployment trends are just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, these trends have become a very hot political issue. But the reality is that much of our losses in industrial age jobs have less to do with government policy and free trade agreements than they do with the dramatic shift in our economy to a knowledge worker age. Do you think it will be threatening to today's workforce to learn the new mindset, the new skill set, and the new tool set of this new age? Imagine what it will take. Imagine what it will take for you and for me. What will it take for us to become a player in this new era? Imagine what it will require of your organization. Peter Drucker compares the industrial manual worker age with today's knowledge worker age this way. Quote, "The most important and indeed the truly unique contribution of management in the 20th century was the 50-fold increase in the productivity of the manual worker in manufacturing. The most important contribution management needs to make in the 21st century is similarly to increase the productivity of knowledge work and the knowledge worker. The most valuable assets of a 20th century company were its production equipment. The most valuable asset of a 21st century institution, whether business or non-business, will be its knowledge workers and their productivity." The great historian Arnold Toynbee said that you could pretty well summarize the history of society and the institutions in it in four words. Nothing fails like success. In other words, when you have a challenge and the response is equal to the challenge, that's called success. But once you have a new challenge, the old one successful response no longer works. That's why it's called a failure. Nothing fails like success. We live in a knowledge worker age, but operate our organizations in a controlling industrial age model that absolutely suppresses the release of human potential. Voice is essentially irrelevant. This is an astounding finding. The mindset of the industrial age that still dominates today's workplace will simply not work in the knowledge worker age and the new economy. And the fact is that people have taken the same controlling mindset home. So often it dominates the way we communicate and deal with our spouses and the way we try to manage, motivate, and discipline our children. Henry David Thoreau once wrote, "There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root." This book is dedicated to striking at the root of the significant problems we face. We started with the pain. Then we explored the underlying problem, one that has personal roots and that involves a deeply embedded paradigm and set of traditions in the workplace. Now let's set the context for the solution and give an overview of how it will be unfolded in the remainder of the book. I've worked with organizations around the world for over 40 years and have been a student of the findings of the great minds who have studied organizations. Most of the great cultural shifts, ones that have built great organizations that sustain long-term growth, prosperity, and contribution to the world, started with the choice of one person. Sometimes that one person was the formal leader, the CEO or president. Very often it started with someone else, a professional, a line manager, someone's assistant. Regardless of their position, these people first changed themselves from the inside out. Their character, competence, initiative, and positive energy, in short, their moral authority, inspired and lifted others. They possessed an anchored sense of identity. They discovered their strengths and talents, their voice, and used them to meet needs and produce results. People noticed. They were given more responsibility. They magnified the new responsibility and again produced results. More and more people sat up and noticed. Top people wanted to learn of their ideas, how they accomplished so much. Little by little, the culture was drawn to their vision and to them. People like this just don't get sucked into or pulled down for long by all of the negative, demoralizing, insulting forces in the organization. Interestingly, their organizations are no better than most organizations. In fact, to some degree, all organizations are a mess. These people just realize that they just can't wait for their boss or for the organization to change. They become an island of excellence in a sea of mediocrity, and it's contagious. Where does a person get such internal strength to swim against the current and to withstand negative cultural provocations, to subordinate selfish interests, and develop and sustain such vision and determination? They learn of their true nature and gifts. They use them to develop a vision of great things they want to accomplish. With wisdom, they take initiative and cultivate great understanding of the needs and opportunities around them. They meet those needs that match their unique talents, that tap their highest motivations, and that make a difference. In short, they find and use their voice. They create their voice. They serve and inspire others. They apply principles that govern growth and prosperity in human beings and in organizations, principles that draw the highest and best from a whole person, body, mind, heart, and spirit. Equally significant, they also choose to influence and inspire others to find their voice through these principles as well. This two-part solution, find your voice and inspire others to find theirs, is a roadmap for individuals at any level of an organization to maximize their fulfillment and influence, to become an irreplaceable contributor, and to inspire their team and the broader organization to do the same. Natural authority is the dominion of natural laws. You can't ignore natural laws, and you have no choice but to operate by them. All actions have consequences. Like it or not, when we pick up one end of the stick, we pick up the other. If you jump off a 10-story building, you can't change your mind at the 5th story. Gravity controls. That is the stamp of nature. Nature has also stamped people with the freedom and power to choose. And therefore, they have natural authority or dominion over all of the rest of creation. Endangered species survive only by our consent. They don't have freedom and power to choose. They lack self-awareness. They can't reinvent themselves. They're totally subject to humans, who, because they are self-aware, alone have the freedom and power to choose. This is natural authority. What is moral authority? It is the principled use of our freedom and power to choose. In other words, if we follow principles in our relationships with each other, we tap into the permission of nature. Natural laws, like gravity, and principles like respect, honesty, kindness, integrity, service, fairness, control the consequences of our choices. Just as you get bad air and bad water when you consistently violate the environment, so also is trust, which is the glue of relationships, destroyed when you're consistently unkind and dishonest to people. By the principled, humble use of freedom and power, the humble person obtains moral authority with people, cultures, organizations, and entire societies. Now let's look at values. Values are social norms. They're personal, emotional, subjective, and arguable. All of us have values. Even criminals have values. The question we must ask ourselves is this. Are our values based upon principles? In the last analysis, principles are natural laws. They're impersonal, factual, objective, and self-evident. Consequences are governed by principles, and behavior is governed by values. Therefore, value principles. People who are starstruck, that is, they're obsessed with celebrities, are an example of those whose values may not be anchored in principles. Popularity shapes their moral center. They don't know who they are and don't know which way true north is. They have no moral compass. They don't know what principles to follow because their lives are based on social values. They are torn between social awareness and self-awareness on the one hand and natural laws and principles on the other. In an airplane, that is called vertigo, where you lose all sense of reference to the ground. We could call those principles, and you become completely lost. Many people walk through life with vertigo or moral mushiness. We all see people like this. You see them in your life and in the popular culture. They've never paid the price of getting deeply centered or of anchoring their values to changeless principles. The key task, then, is to determine where true north is, and then to align everything toward that. Otherwise, you'll live with the inevitable negative consequences that follow. Again, they are inevitable, because even though values control behavior, principles control the consequences of behavior. Moral authority requires the sacrifice of short-term selfish interests and the exercise of courage in subordinating social values to principles. And our conscience is the repository of those principles. Any individual who has had a profound influence on others, on institutions, or on society, any parents whose influence has been intergenerational, anyone who has really made a difference for good or ill, possess three common attributes: vision, discipline, and passion. I suggest that these three attributes have ruled the world from its beginning. They represent leadership that works. Consider just a few notable leaders from modern history. George Washington had a vision of building a new nation, united and free from foreign interference. He disciplined himself to learn how to recruit, supply, and keep people from deserting the Revolutionary Army. Angered by discrimination against colonial military officers, British land policies, and restriction on U.S. expansion, Washington was passionate about the cause of liberty. Florence Nightingale, the founder of modern nursing, worked her entire adult life to improve the quality of nursing in military hospitals. Her vision and passion overcame her personal reticence. Mohandas K. Gandhi was instrumental in establishing India as an independent state, though he never held an elected or appointed office. He held no formal position from which to lead people. Gandhi's moral authority created such strong social and cultural norms that it ultimately shaped political will. He governed his life by an awareness of a universal conscience that resided within the people, the international community, and the British themselves. Margaret Thatcher was the first female leader of a great industrial nation. She served three terms as Prime Minister of Great Britain, the longest continuous premiership in the 20th century. Her critics are not few, but she was passionate about urging people to assume the discipline of personal responsibility and to build self-reliance, and she was passionate about bolstering free enterprise in her country. During her tenure in British politics, she helped lift Britain out of economic recession. Nelson Mandela, former president of South Africa, spent almost 27 years in prison for fighting against the apartheid regime. Mandela was impelled by his imagination rather than his memory. He could envision a world far beyond the confines of his experience and memory, which included imprisonment, injustice, tribal warfare, and disunity. Deep within his soul resonated a belief in the worth of every South African citizen. Mother Teresa dedicated herself wholeheartedly, freely, and unconditionally to the service of the poor. She bequeathed her highly disciplined upholding of the vows of poverty, purity, and obedience upon her organization, which has both grown and strengthened ever since her passing. Her famous success formula reads like this: "The fruit of silence is prayer."